If you want to create your favorite Gizmo Sapiens, give the Gizmo Gang a call.
Hello, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 127. With me today is Dr. Sean, our professor of all professors in automation and robotics, and Matt, our political, what do we call you? You're a political consultant?
Junkie?
Political junkie. That's probably accurate, yeah.
And then, of course, I'm Chris, our technological leader, or as I call myself, the God Engineer. Not the God Emperor, but the God Engineer. So, before we started this, we went down the path of talking about the retail apocalypse that everybody has claimed is going to happen, but sales figures for 2018 definitely don't show a collapse of retail buying. But it's been interesting to watch the closure of Sears and Kmart and, you know,
Elder Beerman,
which is local to our area, you know, and what they did wrong and what the stores that are surviving have done right. And I said that I think the winner of the big department store war, because they're still a true department store, they have electronics and toys and clothes and housewares and all that, is Kohl's. And I think part of it is they actually implemented the vision that everybody was talking about 4 or 5 years ago, which was, we're going to make every store a distribution center, as well as a place for people to come and shop. And I think that's been really successful for them, because you can go online, you can see how much product they have at any individual store, you can either call them or go online and order that product and go pick it up, you can have it shipped to your home from that store. My wife actually works at Kohl's, so I have a good insider's view of how it works, and every person who works the floor there carries a phone around, and they answer the phone, and customers call them, and they literally go and act as personal shoppers and pick stuff up off the racks, and they take it to customer service and have it tagged for that person to come in and get it.
Ordering Christmas off the floor.
Yep. Or out of the dressing rooms.
Dressing rooms.
No, it's, but that's been a very successful model, and I don't see Kohl's going out of business. As a matter of fact, they've actually had a 3% year-over-year growth that they believe is actually going to be higher than that. And but you know, we still look at some of these more traditional retailers like JCPenney's and Macy's who are still in business, but the question is for how much longer.
Go ahead.
There's another factor to this that is actually hitting retail. It's in the brick and mortar, you got to pay for space. So you have to overcome the fact that you pay for usually prime real estate in a prime location. And so, like the other buildings in the world, they got bit. They have very good places and locations, but they had to pay rent. And so at some point, when your sales don't even pay the rent, you got to come out of those places. If you go to a more strip mall warehousing model, you can actually alleviate some of that pain by saying, okay, now I don't have to pay as much for that space.
Yeah. Which is why I think the rise of the dollar store is a big result of that.
Look at like Dollar General, who they're headquartered out in Nashville, Tennessee, and up to about 10 years ago, they were kind of a regional player. You know, they had little stores here and there, but there's some statistic, and don't quote me on this, there's like 10 new Dollar General stores or something built or open every day across the country. And I think that's part of it too. I agree with you. You know, it's the rise of that store. But the thing is, it's interesting because I followed retail for a long time, just because it's kind of fascinating how it's the evolution of retail when we look at it. You know, and so you have like department stores, you know, which reason they're called department stores, like I said before, they have departments. You have a toy department, an electronics department, everything. But most department, what we call department stores today is like Macy's and JCPenney's. They sell cosmetics and clothes. They don't sell much else than that. They used to, you know, at the Macy's at the Dayton Mall, they used to have a third floor that was open, and that was all housewares and beds and all this other stuff. That doesn't exist anymore. And I think that's a detriment to them by not having that inventory. But the other thing is, what classifies you as a store is how many turns of merchandise you have. And so department stores typically had 4 turns of merchandise a year, sometimes 3. because it was one turn every season. And then the discount stores, which started with Woolworths, and you know, and then we added the Walmarts and the Meijers and the Kmarts and all of them, they were doing many more turns a year, like 12 turns. And sometime, and today, I think it's every 2 weeks, I think they have 26 turns a year of merchandise. If you look at what, if I mean, because you can literally go in 1 week and think, oh, I'll go in and get that next week when I get paid, and then it won't even be there, and they will never get another shipment of it again. And you know, stores like Dollar General, their turns are constant. But what is interesting that I found out is, like, one of the reasons I think Kohl's is successful too is Kohl's does not follow, as a department store, they don't follow that set number of turns. They are constantly getting new merchandise in all of the time. You know, so they've kind of taken the model, not only have they taken the Amazon model, that they're a distributor, and their stores, although they're show places, are also distribution centers. They've taken the model that I'm not gonna buy X amount of clothes, and it's for this season, and we're gonna keep them for 3 months of the year, and then we'll get new merchandise in. We're gonna consistently and constantly be bringing in new, you know, new items, and that's how you get customers both to shop online and to shop at home. The other thing that we also have found out in the Amazon world, I know I'm talking fast, but I'm used to the whole radio type thing, is, you know, people want to touch something. And, you know, I think that's led to, like, Best Buys, because what there used to be, Circuit City, Best Buy, Suncoast, I mean, there were probably four or five others, because you also had your regional ones, who were all electronics chains, you know, sold computers and TVs and all that stuff. Who's the last man standing, except for Apple and Microsoft, but that's, their stores are dedicated to their products. It's Best Buy. And why do people shop at Best Buy? Best Buy does not have the best prices, although they are getting better about matching online prices if you could find an actual, the exact product. But it's because people want to go in and they want to touch it, particularly something tangible like a laptop or you know, a video game or something like that. And then they want instant gratification, so they purchase it there instead of waiting to go home and get the best deal. You know, that's the thing about shopping online is patience. If you have patience and frankly can wait 2 days for Prime to get it to you, you're going to be a better consumer. But if you don't have patience, and sometimes you don't have time to be patient, you know, that retail story is what you want.
Yeah, but it's a patience versus time thing, because even like the grocery stores now are going more toward ordering. Hey, I know you don't have time, you have a job. Why don't you order all your stuff online and then you tell us when you want it to be ready?
Yeah.
So even if I wait 2 days, I know when it's going to be ready.
Well, and that's interesting, because, you know, for us locally, Kroger's just done the click and pick where you go online and you order your stuff.
Is that free yet?
It is actually. See, here's the thing. I've never paid for it because I keep getting things where, like, if you do it, the first and second time were free, and then I got a thing where if you do it again, we'll give it to you free, and I've got three or four other emails. But there's supposed to be a nominal charge for them to do that. And it, you know, they got that idea from a company called Peapod, who, and the problem, Peapod, I don't know if they still exist. But they were only in big cities originally, like Washington, D.C. And you'd go online, and they would go in, and they would, you know, they actually didn't have grocery stores to pick out of. They had warehouses that they would go, and they would put it together, and they'd deliver it to your house. But it's the same idea, except you're going, just driving into the parking lot, and they load it into your car. I've done it a couple times. It's convenient. It's not perfect. Like, I accidentally ordered a 20-pound bag of flour one day. I meant to order a 5-pound bag, but the pictures look the same on the website. And the price didn't seem out of hand. I guess flour is cheap, but you know, the thing I don't like is you don't get to pick your produce. And, you know, at Kroger's, going through the produce and picking it is sometimes between getting something that lasts a day and getting something that lasts a week. The other thing that's a downside of Kroger doing that is there's so many people, at least at our Krogers, there's so many people who use that service that they're the click and pick pickers are clogging the aisleways. And so I go to shop at the store and I'm one of those, I know exactly what I want. I have my phone out with my list on it and I'm going through the store and I'm going to get it and I'm like running into three or four of those carts every time. I have to wait till one gets out of the way. And
well, but they want that. They want the click and pick. Oh,
yeah.
Want you in the store.
Yeah.
So it's part, I actually have an honor student doing their thesis on sustainability of that type of store, and she's using Kroger's as an example, and that's going to be the wave of the future. They would rather people not be in these stores. And I would probably say Kohl's could be the same way. Yeah, they're a department store, but if you said, hey, I don't want any human beings in here except for my employees, but I want you to order from me, I bet you they would take that in a heartbeat and say, yep, let's do it.
So. I don't know, you know, it would be interesting to see, again, people, particularly clothing, I think that's, you can order clothes online. If you're ordering a specific thing that you know that you have another, like, jeans, you like this brand of jeans and this style.
That's from the customer standpoint, yeah. Though, but from, like, a Levi standpoint, they could give a rat's behind where you're getting it from.
Exactly, but I'm saying, you know, for stores like Kohl's, I think they would lose a lot of customers that way, because that's been the issue with, where Amazon struggles is selling clothing and shoes online.
Right.
Why? Because I have to order it, I have to wait 2 days, if it doesn't fit, then I gotta ship it back. And I mean, Amazon makes it easy. They give you the return shipping label and everything, they make it easy. But still, it's a hassle. You know, and if you can go somewhere and...
Okay, but now...
But here's my issue with the food thing. So, I have food allergies. I have to read the label on almost everything I buy. You know, even stuff that shouldn't have the items in it that have... But they change it. Like, I'm allergic to garlic, which is an odd one. So, French's mustard has garlic powder. Well... Most of the time, I would say 75-80% of the time, if you buy Kroger brand mustard, it doesn't have garlic powder in it. But 20% of the time, they're buying their mustard from French's and it has garlic powder. Although it's the same packaging that they always put it in, it's whoever they're sourcing it from at that time. You know, and it's stuff like that. And they're not the only ones. I mean, no, they change the recipes all the time.
That's easy to overcome in the future. You can come up with an app. That would do
oh
that,
yeah, you so. Could. No, I agree. But the question is why hasn't it been done yet? Because that would be the market segment who would probably love it more so than the regular market segment.
But because there aren't anybody out there that's saying, okay, I would shop here, except I have a food allergy, and therefore,
yeah.
Once that happens, I'm surprised it hasn't happened to the peanut allergies, right?
So well, peanut. Shellfish, salmon. I mean, there's all kinds of food allergies that are common.
But I guess, so that's what I was talking to my mom who worked for Elder Beerman's about, was that traditionally the reason you would pay more at Elder Beerman's, Macy's, so on, because you had a person there to help.
Correct, that customer service feel.
Most of the time in these other places, you don't.
No.
So there's these departments, but you're on your own. If you need to get something, you can flag somebody down and they can help you, but there's not a traditional person.
Yeah.
Greeting you in that department to help you. That has gone away, therefore it's become kind of glorified. I mean, even Kohl's has done that by putting all their cashiers up front.
Oh, exactly.
So you get out of that department mentality, and there is a sacrifice for it. So.
There is. I mean, my daughter works at Dorothy Lane Market, and why do you pay more? I mean, they go through and they train them this way. Why do people go to Dorothy Lane consistently over Kroger's? Well, part of it's the quality of food, which you know you're going to pay more for better quality, particularly the produce and the vegetables. But the other part of it is the customer service aspect. You know, I admit, they have, of any grocery chain ever, they probably have the best customer service ever.
To get back to your point about Kohl's moving the people from the departments to cashiers up front, the thing about that is that the next evolution of that is what's happening at Walmart, where they closed all their stores on Christmas nationwide so that all four of their cashiers could spend time with their family. My point is that these stores are becoming
Amazon.
You're an employee when you walk through the door.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, heck,
it seems to work.
Think about Cub Foods. They never had baggers. You know? And you'd go in and you're essentially working for yourself, bagging your own food.
Well, and by the way, this all goes back. This is not brand new stuff.
Europe, oh, no, not
Europe,
at all.
Europe is that way. This. Yeah, back in the Middle Ages.
Heck, look at
would sit there and just wring your stuff.
But look at Aldi.
Yeah.
And Aldi's expanding huge in the United States and Canada.
And that is how Germans do it.
Yeah, you have to pay. You pay a quarter to get a cart. Now, you get your quarter back when you're done, but you pay a quarter to get a cart.
You pay for bags if you want them.
Yeah, every time I don't like shopping at Aldi. Not because they have bad stuff. It's just I never have change on me, so I never can get a cart.
So you need to come out to the Huber one because we pay it forward out in Huber at Aldi. Uh-huh. There's always a quarter in the thing, so you just pay it forward when you're done, and you're all good.
But, you know, what does that mean? You know, Amazon bought Whole Foods, which is, you know, for them was a different gig. And I actually haven't been into the Whole Foods store since they bought them last year. Not because I don't like Whole Foods, but because that's not a place I think you go to buy your everyday groceries either. But, you know, now they're on the West Coast. They now have the almost employee-less store. The store that has two employees and all they do is stock shelves, you know. And you put all the stuff in your bag. You don't even go to a register and check out. The app checks you out as you leave the door, you know. And Sam's Club has moved that way, too.
I was just going to say that.
You know, they have the app you put on, and you do it, and you pay with Apple Pay right there in the, you know, after you, and you don't even have, it doesn't even print your receipt. You show them your phone, and they go, it's really annoying when they take that marker and put a smiley face on your phone. But, you know, it's interesting what retail's going to bring. I think it's still going to be a mixed bag of things. People still want to see items. That's what's made the Apple Store and Microsoft and Best Buy and even Kohl's to a large degree. They may not buy there, but typically they're going to get some kind of sales out of it.
But I think the key takeaway from that, though, is that your stores are going to be smaller and more specialized.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's so that they can manage the cost of having employees
deal with customers. You also look at, like, you know, Apple every year has the highest dollar per square foot or revenue per square foot of any retail space ever. And that's a big deal, like, you know, that Sean said. And that's why it's a head-scratcher to me about Sears. Because Sears Holding Company, who owns Sears and Kmart and did own Craftsman and everything else, they are the largest real estate company in the United States. They're bigger than Trump. You know, they own more commercial real estate than anybody else, and yet they couldn't keep it together. Now, I think they have a... If you look at it, there's a lot of small, bad decisions that were made that just avalanched over a 20-year period. Or 30 or 40 year period. But, you know, my personal opinion is the guy who's currently in charge, Eddie Q, or not Eddie, is that his name? I can't remember the guy's name. It's Eddie something. You know, I think he's just, he's the single largest, his hedge fund is the single largest investor of Sears Holding Corp, and he's loaned Sears Corporation money and all this other stuff. He's just looking for a massive tax write off, I think. Because, he's trying to keep part of Sears open for a while, at least a while longer, and all the creditors are asking their bankruptcy court to bankrupt or, you know, shut Sears down and divvy up the...
Like they got a week left, and if they don't get an offer, it's liquidation time.
Yep. But, you know, it's, I don't know what it is, but it's not like I loved Sears as a store. But I think I like the concept of Sears. It's kind of like the British department stores that have been around for 100 years, like Lloyd's in London. What was the show on PBS about Selfridge? Selfridge's store. I mean, Selfridge's store still exists, even though it's not owned by his family anymore.
But, you know, the Sears Roebuck Company was an American institution for, and they revolutionized through the late 18th century and the 19th, or late 18th century, late 7th, not good, late 19th century and 20th century, how people bought and items.
But, you know, they're a victim of their own success in that they didn't allow creative destruction to constantly reinvent their business.
Correct.
Once you get stuck in that mold, you've put yourself on the calendar for when your expiration date is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not the only ones. Look at Toys R Us. Toys R Us was the largest worldwide toy retailer for how long? And they couldn't figure out how to... I think they're probably the worst decision they made was, let's partner with Amazon to sell toys. You know? But, and you know, supposedly they're going to resurrect Toys R Us in some way, kind of like they're resurrecting Elder Beerman online or whatever they're doing. But, you know, whatever they're going to do, it's not going to work because now Walmart and Target and Kohl's are your big toy retailers. And, you know, if you need something specialized or you want that one item that's hard to get, Amazon is always going to be the place to go. My only fear with Amazon is, and hopefully the market will correct this relatively soon. And when I say soon, in the next 5 to 10 years. But Amazon's poised to become a monopoly in that marketplace. I know there was that one company who tried to come in. I can't even think of their name. That's how obscure they are at this point. You know, to be an only an online retailer and kind of be like Amazon. But the problem, I even signed up and got an account with them, and they had some good deals on stuff, but they didn't have nearly the relationships with the manufacturers to have offer the same breadth and width of product. You know? And so I think if they're still around, I think that's what they struggled with.
Well, I'm sure at some point Elon Musk will venture into the Amazon space, because that's what he does.
I mean, Oracle's been playing around. Amazon's going into cloud services and networking.
Oh, yeah. Dot
Hayden. What's his face at Oracle has the ability to take them down if he wanted to. Right now he's fat, dumb, and happy because he's getting money from them. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that Larry Ellison and the position that Oracle as a company could really challenge AWS at this point. I think the person who really could challenge them, and they're at least competitive with them in the marketplace, is Microsoft. And the cloud space, I'm actually not so unhappy with the way it looks today, because there's lots of choice, and they're pretty competitive against each other. I mean, Amazon, yes, is the largest. You know, it's kind of like Apple in the smartphone market. But at least there's 10 other competitive cloud providers out there that you could choose from if you were unhappy with AWS. The problem with Amazon's retail business or online retail business is that there's, you know, unless you order directly from a manufacturer, which I do a lot for specific things like Apple and Microsoft. If I want something from Microsoft, I just go on their website. I don't try to buy it through Amazon. But a lot of stuff, and I mean, it's easy too. I love Amazon. You have the app on your phone. I have it bookmarked on my computer. You go and you search, and oh wow, or if you're in a retail store, because I do this all the time to price comparison, I pull the Amazon app and I hit the barcode button and I zap the barcode and I look and see, well, is it cheaper on Amazon? And sometimes I'll buy it from the store because Amazon's no cheaper, and it's not like you don't pay sales tax on it now. You know, so that's a wash. It used to be, oh well, you know, after sales tax, so Amazon would be cheaper, but not anymore. Speaking of sales tax, that's got to go.
I would be okay with the sales tax if we could get away with doing away with the income tax.
Income tax, property tax. Yeah, I'd be okay with sales tax if that were the case. I'd be okay with a higher sales tax if that were the case.
not much higher than
no.
Yeah,
but you know what?
I'd be willing to trade that off.
Here's the thing about sales tax. So everybody talks about, we're going to segue here a moment. Everybody talks about taxes and, you know, this whole graduated tax thing, you know, because it's unfair to people who make less money than it is to people who make more money. Well, we live in a capitalistic country. A dollar's a dollar. If you can only make 10 of them or you can make a billion of them, a dollar's a dollar. Sales tax taxes everybody equally. Income tax does not tax everybody equally. Right now it taxes the middle more than it does, you know, it's a bell curve.
The problem with that, seeing as now we're moving into a political realm, the problem with that is we have roughly just under 50% of the country that says that's horrible. And then just less than 50% that says that's awesome. There is no consensus as to what's the best way forward.
Yeah.
Until we figure that out, we'll see no movement in either direction.
I know.
Which sucks, because taxation is
theft. This is going to be an odd statement. I'm hoping the government shutdown lasts until September, when they have to re-up the military funding. Because I think what people are going to find out is they don't need that 20% of the government that is not working. I wish the IRS had been caught up in that. That'd have been great.
Yeah, no kidding.
A true government shutdown is when you get your paycheck and you don't see that they take any taxes out of it at all.
Yeah.
Get back to me when, is what I'm saying now. Plus, the other thing that's aggravating about this is the people that are currently affected by that, and by that I mean employees,
yeah,
they're still getting paid.
Oh, I know.
They may not get paid right now, but they will get their money.
Yes. Yeah.
The point I made on Facebook this morning is what would a true government shutdown would be more like we're laying these people off.
Exactly. And that's what a commercial company would do. Oh, we don't have the budget. We can't afford to pay you anymore. You know.
Go find another job. We'll pay you a little pittance so that you can go to your county job and family services and sign up for all the unemployment benefits and all that. Correct.
And if you want to go totally political, what Trump is doing is not unheard of. In fact, Congress does this all the time, the power of the purse.
Exactly.
They defund stuff all the time to control the political landscape.
Yeah.
Trump happens to be by himself versus the 8,000.
Well, I don't think he's by himself.
I don't think he's by himself, but I mean, that's what he's the figurehead.
That's what the media is saying.
But this is what has always been done, is if Congress wants something done, one side of the aisle will say, okay, we won't fund X until you do this. And it just happens to be a political thing that we're funding this time. So this is...
Well, that goes back to, just to reiterate your point, reemphasize it. How many times has Congress passed laws funding this wall?
Uh-huh.
And then the next Congress just doesn't pay for it.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's exactly what's happened. So.
If Congress truly thought they had the power, they would allow Trump to not, ratify this budget without pass it themselves. They know they can't. And they're playing games with everything. And at some point, somebody's got to be the bad guy and address immigration. And so Trump decides to do that. Now, whether I agree with the wall or not, I do agree with the fact he's doing something rather than nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And he's using the power of the purse, which, again,
is
been used since 1776.
Yeah. And it's something he legally can do.
Absolutely.
You know. But, you know, and people tend to forget the whole checks and balances issue. You know, it's part of the reason we're essentially a tricameral government with a bicameral, bicameral house.
Well, it depends. Cortez, it's what camels.
You know, I just watch her and it's like
the gift that keeps on giving.
It's like they elected Dumb and Dumber to be their congressman in New York. It tells you a lot about New York. It tells you they're not connected to the rest of the country, for one thing. But it also tells you that, you know, I guess it tells you that no matter how poorly educated you are, you can get somewhere in life. You know, and live and
God bless America.
Yeah,
is all I can say.
And not have a, you know, and you know, do your public service for a non-living wage. I loved that. That was my favorite one. She makes what, $174,000 a year?
But not yet.
Well, January 1st.
She hasn't even taken office yet, and she's having to take a vacation so that she can do her job. I'm flabbergasted.
God, I wish I could get away with that.
Self-care break.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny. One of the headlines I read yesterday was about how many times Trump has gone to play golf and how many senior cabinet people have, you know, rotated in and out. And all I can think of when I hear that is everybody's like, well, you know, that's a bad thing. And I'm thinking, well, he's found out that these guys he agreed to take on are establishment, you know, politicians, and that's not his game. He's not an establishment politician person at all. It wouldn't matter if he were Republican or Democrat. He would not be an establishment politician. And you bring in these guys like, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Mad Dog Mattis, but I've worked for generals like him before, and they're as political as any politician out there, probably even more so, because that's how they got to be the rank that they're at, is by being totally political. But two, they do not have a good perspective on the real world. When you dedicate your one of the master sergeants I worked with in the Air Force, when he got out, he goes, today will be the first day that I get to practice democracy and not protect it. And you know, they don't, they live in a bubble. And yes, they deal with things that I don't want to, at his level, they deal with things that I don't want to know about sometimes. But the rest of the world, the way the world operates, they live in a bubble and they don't understand it. And you know, and so because they're so political and they're kind of disassociated with the world, they have preconceived notions on how everything should be done. And I don't think that's something... I think that's where Trump bumps against these advisors and things, is that, you know, he's like, well, wait a minute. In the real world where I lived before I decided to become president, this is how things operated, and this is how you got things done. You know, and I think that's part of the whole border wall thing, too. If he were trying to get funding from, or to do something with, you know, a bank or something else, he would use any kind of leverage he could against them to get what he wanted. You know, that's why I also think the whole Mueller investigation is just hilarious. If he really had anything, I think they would have put all the indictments out at this point. But I don't think he has anything. And then there's also the issue that I don't believe you can indict a sitting president. There are actually some laws around that. They can, when he's no longer president, you can indict him as long as the statute of limitations has run up, but not while he's sitting president. And that's going to be another issue, because that would actually require Congress and the Senate to change the law.
But I come back and I ask the question, what is the scope of the investigation? That the Russians somehow did something?
Okay, so let's get this straight. For the last 100 years, we have messed with the elections and things with all these other governments across the world. And frankly, I don't think manipulating Facebook advertising constitutes, you know...
Nobody seemed to care when Barack Obama tried to get Netanyahu thrown out in Israel.
Yep.
Nobody gave a damn. So I ask, what difference does it make if Russia buys a few Facebook ads? I don't...
Well, okay.
What's the crime there?
Exactly. Well, that's my point, is, you know, if they did it through legal means, buying Facebook ads, and yeah, the ads were manipulative, but that's what's called. So
that's advertising.
Correct.
Well, I mean,
or
that's
marketing.
The very definition of marketing. I mean, they've done nothing wrong.
You know, so it's kind of interesting in relation to that. So, do you guys listen to the Mike Rose podcast? And that's the way I heard it. So it's usually he tells a small story and it's about somebody famous. I can't remember, and he does one. It's either I think it's weekly. He does one, and they're great. They're great stories, you know. But I was listening to one, and it's been several months, and he talks about this guy who worked for Macy's Corporation, and essentially he was like the first guy who was really an advertisement or marketing man. Well, he was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and his nephew was Joseph Goebbels. This is because it was pre-World War II. And he called it propaganda. You know, and after World War II, they decided to change it because Goebbels was Minister of Propaganda for the Third Reich, and so then it became marketing. And so, again, if we allow companies to advertise and don't have a problem with that, then we shouldn't have a problem with Russia buying ads that essentially do the same thing. They were advertising for who they wanted to be, the person they had to deal with. I don't have a problem with that. I'd have a bigger problem if Russia hacked into Facebook and then, you know, published all this stuff, you know.
I don't even push that aside. If Russia hacked into our Ohio's election system.
Yeah.
And actually changed votes?
Yeah, that would be an issue.
I got an issue with that. Now, what's Trump got to do with that?
If exactly.
If Trump hired the Russians to do it, now we have a crime.
Well, even if Trump hired the Russians to buy Facebook advertising, I don't see a crime there, so.
Yeah. I
like I was explaining to somebody else, all of that is under President Obama's watch. The sitting president is
responsible
for the election.
Yep.
So if you go after one, and it gets into, again, 2 years, and you talk about wasting money, 2 years and you got a couple indictments online. Okay, yeah. And by the way, I can get anybody anytime
online. Yeah.
It's very easy.
They're politicians. Yeah. I mean, and Michael Kelly,
as we know,
took a risk.
Well, and as we know from the Clinton investigation, that's what they use, kind of like tax evasion for mobsters, right? I know you did something. I can't prove it. I want to end this. So here's what I'm going to do. How about we get you online? Okay. And let's go away. I mean, that's, again, what we're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's out of hand. What I think is so interesting about it, and what I will say this, it makes the news really unpleasant to read, is this whole, if you did a poll, I think you'd find that most people are not affected by it and they don't care about the outcome of a lot of this, but it's the media trying to generate more media. You talk about propaganda generation by making everything sound so bad on every side. You know, there I can't stand to watch television news, partly because television news does not have the right of freedom of speech. You know, there is censorship involved there, and so they have to even make it more sensationalized to get people, get that viewership so that they get those advertising dollars. But, you know, it's the media that is really so bipartisan. You know, because you have one side, you know, very hard to the right and one side very hard to the left, but there's nobody telling the story in the middle. It's kind of, you know, you're kind of reading between the lines. Because I've always firmly believed that even if you don't agree with it, there's no harm in reading it.
The problem is that if there is somebody in the center telling the story, neither side believes it.
Very true.
Because journalism in this country has become such a clown show that
Well, we finally taken. We're almost to the point where we're like the BBC News. I loved when I was over in England a couple summers ago. I loved watching the BBC News because it was like everything was a feel-good story. And they didn't want to talk. They didn't hardly ever talked about international relations or anything like that. Right now, it's entertaining because all they talk about is Brexit and what they're going to do. And I'm thinking, the Irish border is not that important. If you really think the war is going to start up again because you start a border, Great Britain, take over Ireland. Just do it. Flick your middle finger to the European Union and say, look, you lost two countries.
Well, because it's gotten to the point now where you have newscasters competing against independent people doing podcasts and stuff like that, and they want to be the news. You know, the Woodward and Bernstein scene, I want to be that person. I want to be that person in conversation. And so, like, NBC, a good example, NBC the other night. If they're reporting the news wasn't that Trump did not go to the Middle East to visit the troops, yet they reported that.
Yeah.
He also, by the way, probably used the bathroom 3 times and probably didn't go to Mar-a-Lago. He probably didn't go to California. He probably didn't go to Canada.
Yeah.
There's other, you know, how do you report when something doesn't happen? So you do that because you want to create a hit piece and create a story.
Well, yeah, Matt and I've talked about this before, about the whole 24-hour news cycle. You know, when CNN first started as the first 24-hour news station, there probably was enough new news at the time that they could run 24 hours and they would repeat themselves very little. But then when CNBC and, you know, all these other news networks started up and started offering 24-hour news, now there was this competition. I mean, it's capitalism. There's a competition to be the first one to break news. But then also, because some of the smaller stations realized that, hey, nobody's reporting on this yet. And so they jumped on some of the lesser stories, and they got to report it first. And so people would switch viewership over there, which changed advertising dollars. And, you know, it's an interconnected thing. But today, because you have all these 24-hour news shows on a 24-hour news cycle, and they're repeating themselves not just once or twice during the day, but once every hour, you know, anything that they can do to make something new and to draw attention to themselves is, you know, and so now we get the point counterpoint shows, but, you know, CNN will broadcast something, and then Fox News has the counterpoint show to talk about why that's bunk, and then CNN has their counterpoint show to, you know.
The point there is that the definition of journalism has moved from objective news to an opinion-based infotainment.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the same thing.
Very true. But what I think, particularly with a lot of people who are no longer subscribing to cable, the, you know, cord cutters, it's not just a fringe movement. It's a significant amount of people. I mean, I don't have cable. I have cable internet, but I don't have cable TV. Why would I have that?
Because your wife wants it.
No.
In 4 rooms. With only one TV ever on, and it's just on for noise. Maybe that's just me.
Yeah, I think it's just you. But that being said, you know, they're losing a lot of viewership because of that. That's a whole nother discussion. It's the whole cord cutting and what it's done to cable TV. It might actually the market might actually force cable TV to do what they should do, which is unbundle channels. You know, you pay $1 a month for the 12 channels you want.
There's a problem with that. That's what we want. There's a problem with that, though, when you do that, and that's probably for another show, but
yeah,
you don't make profit on that because you got to pay license fees.
Well,
so if you want ESPN 1 and 3, but not 2,
I only want the Ocho, so...
Exactly. No, I watch the Ocho all the time. But when you do that, then you don't get that license fee. And that's why when these companies, or like Spectrum now, that's who I'm slave to. If you look at it and you start bundling what you want, you end up not paying much more because they make it so convenient.
Oh, I know.
And so, like CBS Network now, so the only way they can entice you is to put a Star Trek on CBS, the old CBS, you can't get anywhere else, All Access or whatever, and you got to pay $10 subscription fees. So if I'm going to pay $10 here, well, I might as well add on to that, you know. Hulu Sling Box does the same thing.
Yeah.
So when they package these things, they're packaging by the how much they can get away with license fees, and unfortunately, consumers still get screwed.
Well, but you know, so you look at, because I have Spectrum too, and you look at what they have to offer from a television perspective, and what do you watch? So when we had cable, we had like 200 channels, and we watched, now when my kids were younger, we watched like Cartoon Network and Disney Channel, and my kids weren't big Nickelodeon watchers, so Nickelodeon could have gone out the window. And then there, what's the other Cartoon Network channel, the classic one? But they watched those three. We watched all the local stations.
Boomerang?
Yeah, Boomerang. That's it.
Yeah.
And we watched all the local stations, and we watched like Sci-Fi and Discovery Channel or something like that. So you pay for 200 channels. Now, what's happening because of the cord-cutting movement is, so, you know, the cable company's kind of caught in between. So they own all the infrastructure and have to maintain it, which is a huge cost. And then they're charging you for maintenance of that infrastructure, and they're also, but they're being charged to, you know, by the people. So, you know, Disney owns ESPN, ABC, all these channels. So if you want, if you're a cable company and you just want Disney Channel, because that's all people are asking for, you have to take everything else, because they won't let you have it without everything else, which increases the licensing fee on their end. But this cord cutting thing is changing it, because the cable companies can't, they're not getting the revenue anymore. They're not able to pay the licensing fees. No, not paying licensing fees makes the content distributors now have to reevaluate. Well, it's better to get some money than it is no money, you know? Because how many times in the last couple of years have you turned on cable TV and there's this plea of you know, you will not have channel Fox 45 on your network unless, you know, your cable company comes to an agreement with so-and-so.
But you know, another part of this whole licensing thing comes down to the fact that, and I don't know, maybe this applies to this and maybe it doesn't, so I'll throw this out there and you throw it aside if you'd like. But Americans have made a choice to get as much for free as possible. The downside of that is that what we've done is we've allowed tech companies, including our media conglomerates, to take all of our personalized information and basically sell it as a revenue stream so that they could provide the free service.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Does that tie into this?
Not so much.
Sort of, but not really.
No, I mean, not so much. It does tie into it from the Nielsen perspective, because Nielsen as a company is really suffering. One, they kind of lost credibility as a ratings, because, you know, Nielsen built a business on determining how many people were watching any given television show at any given time.
Where I think this comes in is the fact that you got like CBS All Access saying, pay us $10.50 a month or whatever it is, and we'll give you access to all this stuff. My problem with that is what are they doing with all that data that they're collecting?
You know, I don't know. You have to read through the EULA. I mean,
and
which people don't do.
Which is how we got into this problem in the first place.
But you know, what I don't have so much a problem with the streaming services. Because, unlike the cable company, I can go online, I can cancel it. I don't have to call them. And you're not really giving them a whole lot of data, at least the ones I use. Netflix and Hulu don't collect a whole lot of data. You collect what you watch, of course, but all of them are going to do that because that's an easy metric to see. And I don't have a problem with CBS All Access. If you want to watch Star Trek Discovery, then you're willing to pay that you know, that's you picking the channel you wanted to watch.
Yeah.
And you know, again, it's not the only thing that they have on that channel, so they're giving you more. But I like that model, even though it costs more than the cable model, where you have to take an extra 190 channels that you're never going to watch, and you're going to be paying for them and charged for them for that. Because if you really think about it, I mean, everybody, if you're an Amazon customer and you're a Prime customer, you get Amazon Prime for free. They have some great programming, probably better than broadcast TV programming. Man in the High Castle is undeniably awesome.
Absolutely.
I've recently been rewatching Star Trek Discovery. I think CBS All Access is worth it for that show. If you're a Star Trek fan and you really want, you're going to do it. I think Netflix is a great value. I don't know if you guys have watched the new Bandersnatch Black Mirror movie that came out. It's a choose your own adventure. You actually get to choose the outcome. There's over I don't know how many. There's five endings you can get, but there's like over a million combinations of the show. And it can take you from 90 minutes to 2.5 hours to watch the whole thing. And then you get to watch it again. My youngest daughter and I watched it this morning. It's pretty cool. And it's well done in the Black Mirror style. But, you know, if I look at what I pay for the three services, well, four services, because I have Hulu too, and Amazon Prime, I'm already getting, it's less than my cable bill ever would have been, including my internet service. So, you know, I think that model actually works. People buy what they want. You know, the Sling model, which is IPTV, I think harkens back to the cable model too much. You have to buy a package of a whole bunch of stations you could care less about, you know. And I know I'm going to say something blasphemous, but I don't care about ESPN. ESPN does not show UK basketball, and it doesn't usually show Buckeye football, so I don't care.
True. The problem you have with all that, then, is you'll get competing, just like you have networks competing now, so like Big Ten Network, for instance. If your cable pack doesn't have Big Ten Network, then you miss X number of games because rival networks are grabbing. Amazon Prime, Netflix, Hulu, they compete against each other.
Oh, I know.
So that very thing just happened to me with cable.
Well, the blackouts on the Bengals games.
Well, we'll come back to MLB TV in a minute. The World Series had a game on MLB Network, which wasn't in my sports package on cable. So my baseball star stepson wants to watch the World Series because his Dodgers are playing in the World Series. I have to shell out another $20 so I can watch 3 days worth of games that are on MLB Network, which drove me absolutely nuts. MLB TV is great. That's their streaming service where you can watch every game except for your team. Makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, that's actually less to do with Major League Baseball and more to do with your local franchise. If you're local, they want you to go to the game. They don't want you to see it on.
No. This is about Fox Sports Net having their contract with the franchise to broadcast.
Yeah. But, you know,
130
I will say this. Sports,
so you're partly right.
Sports is a problem.
Yes, sports is a problem.
Because it doesn't fall in those categories. Now, Amazon, you can, you know, get a lot of games, and actually their quality is excellent, I've thought, on the ones I've watched. But the, you know, live sports is that should be the domain of your local stations over the year, frankly. There should be no blackouts locally. Just because there are economic reasons you can't go to a game, there's, you know, fiscal reasons you may not be able to go to a game. And you know, these networks I think are unsustainable in the long haul. Not just the sports networks, but I think it also applies to these news networks as well, because you know, the one thing that is interesting about all the news networks is that they don't do anything. It would be so easy in today's, with today's technology, for a CNN to, when you turn your TV on, they also give you local news, but they don't. Whereas if you turn on your local NBC affiliate or ABC affiliate or CBS affiliate at 6 o'clock and 10:30 at night, you get not only all the national news, but you get the local news, you know. It's an interesting concept, but I think we've beat this all to death. And so we want to hear from you, our listeners, at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's G-I-Z-M-O-S-A-P-I-E-N-S @gmail.com. And we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.